May it please the Court, Mr. Rathbun. Good morning. I'm Robert Lindstrom. I am co-counsel for the appellant, Wells Fargo Bank, in this matter. I am here this morning with my co-counsel, Mr. Randall Mitchell. This is a case about a knowledgeable, experienced Illinois farmer marketing his grain.
Mr. Lindstrom, before you get too much further, there's a lot of material in this record, but this case, unlike many that we see, actually does wind up getting tried to the court. And so you would agree that our standard of review is clear error. And it was my strong impression that Judge Dryagian found that Mr. Siegel was not particularly experienced or sophisticated, at least when it came to trading futures. Maybe he was a great farmer, for all I know, but not on this point. So it would be very helpful for me, at least, to be really clear on your part where it is you're saying you think findings of fact by the district court flunk the clear error test, where it is you think, if there is any place that you think we're looking at a question of law, where it is.
Mr. Siegel's testimony was that in the 1970s he first began trading grain futures, and he then also testified that in the 1980s he opened up a joint trading account with his brother. Now, the significance of that is Mr. Siegel is a grain farmer. He produces a crop that he sells for cash. So at that time, he was marketing, as he testified, his cash crop through a grain elevator, but at the same time, he was seeking to enhance his profit, if you will, by trading in the futures market through a brokerage firm called Stotler & Company. In the 1990s, Mr. Siegel testified that he became acquainted with Tywalk and their farmer marketing program. And he testified that he, in effect, transferred his futures trading to that program. And that program consisted of 7 cash grain contracts that incorporated futures pricing and the pricing of the commodity that was to be delivered. So we believe that his knowledge and background in prior trading through a brokerage firm, and indeed he also testified that he had taken some grain marketing courses, shows that he had experience in something other than selling cash grain.
So the district court finds that there is an oral agreement between Mr. Siegel and Tywalk, as I understand it, effectively for Tywalk to sell the physical grain. But the district court finds that there is insufficient evidence to prove an oral agreement for the futures trading with Tywalk.
And that's what we believe is clearly erroneous. What we believe the court is not given proper consideration for are the documents. This gentleman, for over 5 years, and it's in the record, signed over 200 contracts as part of the farmer marketing program.
What, in your view, is the significance of these documents? Is it that they demonstrate that Siegel had agreed to a general discretionary account with Tywalk, or instead that he authorized particular transactions?
The court seemed troubled by a no seminal document for the farmer marketing program.
I'm asking what your argument is. I'm not asking who seemed troubled by something.
In its place are these contracts where he...
Could you tell me, please, your argument?
My argument
is... Answer my question.
My argument is the contract set forth what the parties agreed to do.
Well, that's not an answer.
It's not an answer to my question.
Here is the two options. Option A, there is an umbrella agreement with Tywalk, the open trading account, if you will, that you can do all sorts of trades on my account, we'll settle up from time to time, whatever people do. Option B is there is a spot contract on February the 8th, 1999, and there's another one on December 1st, 1999, and those are all little individual contracts. Maybe there is no overriding agreement. And I wondered, too, what's your theory of this case? Did you ever argue that these individual contracts were enforceable and you are due something netting out where they all came?
we believe that the basis for our claim are these contracts. This is the reason for my earlier comment about...
Still not answering the question. Choose A or B, as Judge Wood phrased it.
The contracts serve as a basis for our claim. We don't believe that Mr.
So they are evidence of your claim. Let me just rephrase this, and you can tell me if it's wrong. You are using these contracts as evidence of some background umbrella general trading account agreement.
Yes. Yes, I am.
You don't care about the contracts otherwise as individual events.
Well, you indicated a moment ago that Mr. Siegel perhaps had ceded his discretion of some trading to Taiwan. We don't believe he did that.
I know that's your position, but I'm just trying to, like Judge Easterbrook, I looked at these contracts, and I actually have another question for you about them when we finish this up, but I looked at them and I wasn't sure what you wanted them for. You've now said that they are actually just evidentiary material to show that there was a general agreement between Mr. Siegel and Taiwan.
Yes.
Okay.
So did you, one final follow-up question on this one. Did you, in the district court, try to figure out what the balance would have been if the only contracts were the things that Siegel signed? What would the balance between Siegel and Taiwan have been?
That's what, that's what's reflected on the commodity statements. At the end of the day, at the bottom.
No, I'm not asking about all trades. I'm asking about the trades that were authorized in the particular signed contracts. If you looked at those and disregarded everything else, what would the balance have been? Did you provide that figure to the district court?
Yes, in the commodity statements. The gentleman would sign a contract, and before expiration, he would cancel it and replace it with a new one. The commodity statements are the sum total of what was going on.
So there is an individual written contract that lies behind everything reflected in the commodity statements.
Yes. The commodity statement is a summary of the contracts. It's a summary of what happened when a contract was replaced, whether he made money or lost money, and it's also a summary of the costs that Taiwan charged to do the transaction. There was a charge per bushel to do a transaction that's listed on the front of the contract. The commodity statement is a summary of what happened when a contract was replaced with a new one.
Now, here's my just this is a very particular point. You keep talking in your brief that about the number $380,525.32, and you keep referring to this August 24, 2001. Commodity statement that you put in the appendix. Now, when I found it very hard, by the way, to follow the way you referred to your appendix. You would say, you know, appendix 8, which makes me think of page 8, but no, you mean item 8, but you don't give any page references. But anyway, on page 43 of this August 24, 2001 commodity statement, you come to the number net due Taiwan / paren U. $206,328.50. So that's obviously not 380. I went through every page of this statement, and I could not find anything that corresponded to the number 380. So I don't know where it's coming from.
It would be the sum total of each of the items reflected at the bottom where it says amount due from you or to you from Taiwan.
Some of them say due and payable October 1st, 2004, then we have 2006. I couldn't make them add up. I mean, you never did say, you know, if you look at the numbers on pages this, this, and this, you'll come up with 380.
What Mr. Siegel did was he traded multiple crop years, and you'll see the numbers on there. It'll say 198. That means 1998.
I'm just saying you never – I shouldn't have to sit there and wade through this long statement trying to figure out where you even get your number from. And I'm telling you, I spent quite a bit of time trying to do it.
I acknowledge there's no sum total.
Judges were inclined to write in the margin, I think, things like, I object or not right. But then Siegel had already done that.
Yeah, no, well – Siegel did, but Siegel also, there's nothing in the record in documentary evidence or testimony that Siegel ever said, stop, let me get out. And that's a very significant factor here when he says, I didn't know what I was doing, explain this to me, stop the world, I want to get off. And in fact, he for 3 years got confirmations from the company's auditor setting forth numbers that he had indeed objected to for a couple of years, but at the end he did not.
I don't understand, by the way, why, if you get back an objection to an audit, IWOC does not at that point have a duty to say, okay, we need to reconcile these objected to figures on an annual audit, and if we can't come to an agreement, our arrangement is over. I mean, we've been through this in a way in securities law, and I'm kind of puzzled by the fact that neither side has cited the rather extensive law on how this problem is dealt with in discretionary securities trading. The confirmations are viewed as evidence of a discretionary account, but if the client ever objects, it's all over. And here, the client objected at one point.
Well, we don't.
IWOC went right on making discretionary trades.
There's the key, Your Honor. We don't believe IWOC did do discretionary trades here. We don't believe that they did anything without this gentleman's approval when he signed the contract. That's the difference.
All these contracts, however, came after the trades. Now, they can be completely effective as authorizing particular trades, even if they post-date it. And often with discretionary accounts, at least in securities law, the confirmation will say, unless you object in 10 days, you've confirmed this trade. But if somebody does object, the brokerage is at its own risk if it goes on.
But Mr. Siegel,
we do have, you know, written objections at some points.
But the key objection would be to stop, to say, I don't want to do this. He's making it sound like...
So it's a magic words approach? Even if he says, I object, that's not enough to stop the dealer from trading? He has to... Is there some formulary of words he has to use?
Well, Mr. Siegel didn't testify that he told them to stop anything, and there's no document to show that he told them to stop anything. And indeed, as to the count three regarding a loan, there's evidence that he continued to do business with TIWOC right up to the last day there in
business.
But
he does. I mean, in a sense, there are two stories here, and the district court credited one of them. One of the stories is yours, that there was all of this trading, and Mr. Siegel knew perfectly well what was going on, and he's just trying to slip away from a rather substantial debt at this point. The other story is Mr. Siegel was essentially bamboozled by TIWOC. They were doing things that he hadn't really authorized. He was trying in his own way to object to things, and it somehow didn't work, and he really does not owe this money. And the district court buys the second.
Well, Mr. Siegel's background and knowledge of experience of why he transferred his trading from a brokerage firm to TIWOC, I think, is very indicative that he was very knowledgeable. He knew exactly what was going on here.
Well, and I'm sure you argued that to the district court judge, but
yes.
Mr. Gibbons didn't testify. You didn't want him to testify, right?
Mr. Gibbons refused to testify.
Well, but he was already in prison. I don't get that either.
I don't understand refused to testify. There's no such privilege in this society.
He asserted.
Maybe you don't want a felon testifying for you, but he can be made to testify.
He asserted his Fifth Amendment rights at the deposition.
What Fifth Amendment right does he have
after
once
his
he's
conviction.
Already in prison?
Yes.
He has no Fifth Amendment right left. He has double jeopardy to protect him against a...
We didn't believe that it was needed. His testimony was needed. The documents speak for themselves.
Okay.
My time's up. I'd like to reserve time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Rathbun.
Thank you. May it please the court. We look at this as a simple case of the plaintiff's failure to prove its case. I think the trial judge certainly agreed with us. I think if you look very carefully at the record,
I'm worried by a number of things in the district court's opinion. The district court seemed to be saying that if you sign a contract with your fingers crossed behind your back, you're not bound by it.
I agree with you to that extent, and that's
just a legal error, right? If I rent a car from Hertz and they give me a form and I sign it and I got my fingers crossed behind my back, I'm bound by the contract, even if a district judge later believes that I never intended to comply with my contract.
I agree with you. The problem is that nothing ever tied in, and I respectfully disagree with my opponent, nowhere do you tie in any particular unequivocal executed contract to the supposed commodity statements, misnamed monthly statements, really periodic statements.
But what you do have, I mean, I'm willing to look at these various statements, I guess examples of which are at the front of the appendix, as evidence of this overriding oral agreement, not as particular things. But, you know, you look at page after page, and they're all about futures trading. They're, you know, page 4, July 2000 corn futures, you know, corn calls, beans puts, following future transactions. For the district court to say that Mr. Siegel had no idea that he had authorized futures trading seems to me impossible on this record.
I agree to and disagree, Your Honor. I think that when you look at the case that the plaintiff put on, because you don't have if you'd had 200 contracts in a row or 277 in a row, you showed how much was paid, you show how much was done, you'd have 200 contract action on 277 contracts. That wasn't the case that was tried.
But that's
here.
Not right. No, it's not this case. The case is that there was an open trading account, and you know, as you would expect in futures trading, sometimes things get rolled over, but you've got a lot, you've got actually overwhelming evidence here that right in front of Mr. Siegel's face is the fact that this is futures trading that's going on, and then there are individual instances, and he has to either say, I never read a single one, you know, somebody put a piece of paper over it and I signed them all, or I'm not a native English speaker, or something. I don't see where we can say you get to not read anything and just testify that you never intended to take any losses, which didn't seem to me. I mean, no one intends to take losses when they start out in a contract.
I'm not going to take that position, Your Honor. What I'm going to have to do is I'm stuck with the record on the trial. I'm stuck with the plaintiff's case. And basically the plaintiff's case is that you have, excuse the expression, but a rogue trader who there's not one bit in the record showing Mr. Siegel's ever asked a single question about what he wants to do. In fact, Mr. Siegel specifically said he did not agree to engage in futures trading. You have...
Look, you're not responding to the problem.
I'm sorry.
He can say till he's blue in the face, I didn't intend to do X. But if there's a contract with your name on it authorizing a particular futures trade, I don't see how he cannot be bound by that contract. We say till we're blue in the face that you can't avoid something with your signature on it by saying, I didn't read it, or I'm not sophisticated enough to understand it. That's not an excuse in the law of contracts.
I agree. That's been the law since... It's always been the law. The problem here is when
so
you take
it... So why aren't the things he signed binding completely independent of any question whether there was a general discretionary trading account?
Some he signed, some he didn't sign, some he sent back with question marks.
I understand that. I'm asking about the ones he did sign
as opposed to
the ones he didn't sign and the ones he sent back with a question in the margin.
If the case had been tried under that theory, if the defendant had replied under that theory, then the one would have to look and see if the amount of money that they received from him...
Add up the signed contracts, gains, and losses.
Yes, sir.
So it's your point that theory's waived?
My point is they didn't sue on that theory. They didn't try it on that theory. The entire case was tried under it. Basically, what they don't deny is an oral agreement between one person and the judge listened to the testimony about what that oral agreement was, and my client acted consistently with the position that he took. Specifically, when my opponents rely on the Clifton Gunderson audit inquiries, he writes back, he says, no, I don't owe this money. And he did it even on the last one. And I'm sure you'll recall.
The last one is too late.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm talking about the one that he signed it. According to the testimony, he signed it. He put, no, I don't agree. Then he talks to Buzz Gibbons, the convicted felon. He puts back there per conversation of Buzz Gibbons. I don't know what type of an admission that is. But
I have no idea what that meant, actually. I mean, I saw that you relied on it. And then he testifies kind of vaguely. He says, the balances shown above are correct. This is on Appendix 45. Per phone call with Buzz 92800 and its clarifications. But I don't know whether Buzz said, yeah, you remember we really did trade this much, and he says, oh, yeah, you're right, or whether it means that Buzz was, you know, telling him to just say yes even though it was no. I mean, I don't know what to take out of
On the record, that's why I suggest, Your Honor, one can hardly call that an unambiguous admission that one owes the $185,000 or so set forth on that.
It looks to me like that's just what it is. I mean, he's saying, yes, it's correct, and he just says, I've decided it's correct after talking to Buzz, even though we know Buzz, now we know, you know, Buzz may not be the greatest guy.
I think that's one thing parties will both agree on, Your Honor.
Yes.
And I think the problem that we have in this case is that the plaintiff inherited the case from Buzz Gibbons, the fellow who lied to them about what the amounts of grain inventory they had. They inherited a case where Buzz Gibbons was the one who created the scheme that we're being sued under. Interestingly enough, when I looked at the record, I didn't see a single bit of evidence that indicated that any of these trades actually occurred. Advanced Trading was the business that was doing the trades, according to the testimony. According to the two witnesses, the staff people, Mr. Gibbons would tell them what to put on the bills. There's not a piece of paper which says Advanced Trading did this much for the account of Paul Siegel. Contracts require not only the formation of the contract. We didn't get past that. When you get to the second issue of performance, there's nothing here to show performance other than the documents that Mr. Gibbons created, which were the contracts which were supposedly evidence of something that he had supposedly done.
I have a question about that, actually, because I was thinking both about the corn that lay behind the CCC loan and then more generally. Is there evidence that Mr. Siegel was receiving payments from time to time from Tywalk for the actual grain he was shipping to them?
As I understand the testimony and the record, that Mr. Siegel would be consistently paid for the grain that he would deposit within a few days.
So he was paid. I mean, do we know how much he was paid?
I don't know. It varies from year to year, of course. The odd thing is this $400,000.
But there's evidence. If we looked at the record, we could find out that in 1999 he got paid.
That I would submit my grain, I would get paid. The exception is the CCC, where the warehouse receipt was used as security. But that's why I think that the judge was correct in his decision, because on all the other transactions, all the futures transactions, there isn't anything that shows that he ever paid a dime on it. In fact, was this going to last forever?
What evidence were you looking for that would show the trades actually took place?
Records from Advanced Trading. It's a service. Futures trading, I believe, is a service that someone's providing for you. No showing Mr. Gibbons or that Tywalk has any securities license, but there is some evidence by someone that Advanced Trading was doing things. But there's no evidence so much as the monthly statement you get for your retirement account, Your Honor. You get a retirement account which shows things happening.
If you want to show that futures trading took place, you don't look at monthly statements. You look at the behavior of the counterparties. You know, it now sounds like you're saying that Tywalk was a bucket shop. But you can find that out easily enough by looking at the counterparties to the trades.
I don't believe that on the record you can conclude much more than Tywalk is a bucket shop.
The record is what you made it. Did you look for the counterparties to these trades?
Did I look for them? No, Your Honor. I was not the trial counsel. I'm only relying on the record.
You. Your side of the litigation.
I don't know the answer, Your Honor.
If no one looked for the counterparties, it's no surprise there's nothing about them in the record.
That's correct, Your Honor. If there aren't any other questions, I would ask that you would affirm the decision of the court, of the trial court. I think that it can hardly be said that the evidence is clearly erroneous. I think that when you look at the documentary evidence, when you consider where it was generated from, I don't think that either of the cases relied on in this case. Kidd or Anderson talk in terms of when you're trying to decide whether the trial judge's credibility determination should be overridden by documentary evidence. The case, and specifically Kidd, talks about documents when you consider the source of them. Wells Fargo got some documents from Paul Siegel, but he did not create them. He, in fact, is the one who put the question marks, didn't sign some, and signed some others. So in the absence of any other questions, we'd ask you to affirm the trial court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Lindstrom? Or Mr. Mitchell?
May it please the Court, Randall Mitchell, co-counsel for Wells Fargo. Your Honor, it's clear in this record that Mr. Gibbons went to prison not because of anything having to do with his farmer marketing program, but rather because he forged, by his own admission, names to false warehouse receipts regarding corn inventory. It's also clear from the testimony of Ms. St. Germain and Cindy McDonald that the records were generated, maintained, and sent out by them, not personally by Mr. Gibbons, and done so on a regular basis. The Ty Walk and Mr. Siegel had an open account with regard to the farmer marketing program. So notwithstanding the fact that commodity statements came periodically and said, you owe us this much or we owe you this much, they both, by mutual agreement, let that slide. And then ultimately when Ty Walk closed, there was a balance to be paid. The district court cited a case in its conclusions of law called Midland Hotel Corporation versus Reuben Donnelly, Illinois Supreme Court case. And indeed, that case has the most basic lesson, I think, for the court on this case. In that case, pages 313 and 314 of 118 Illinois 2nd, the court said, in order for there to be a contract between parties, there must be meeting of the minds or mutual assent. May I continue just to finish the quote, Your Honor?
I doubt that it is really necessary, counsel.
All right. All right, then.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We ask that the court reverse.
The case will be taken under advisement.